person to do this. This makes all the difference between us and why we are non-believers. We can handle the truth, we can face the facts, and we can live good, loving, productive, meaningful, hopeful, and happy lives knowing the truth. It makes no difference to us how in that billion years nothing we do will matter. However, what we do matters to the one we love and who loves us. The emotional and physical pain we experience in our lives is the same as believers. What we don't have to struggle with, as Habermas does, is the intellectual pain of God's silence when we suffer. That kind of pain adds to the pain of suffering. We don't have it. We are better off without it. Death and suffering are what we expect in life. We take the good with the bad. We can only hope that we have more happiness in our lives than pain. I'm reminded here of M. Scott Peck's famous opening to his book, The Road Less Traveled. Life is difficult. This is a great truth, one of the greatest truths. It is a great truth because once we truly see this truth, we transcend it. Once we truly know that life is difficult, once we truly understand it and accept it, then life is no longer difficult. Because once it is accepted, the fact that life is difficult no longer matters. Like Habermas and other believers, everyone experiences suffering and pain, some of us more than others. Non-believers just don't have to struggle with why life is difficult, and that makes all the difference. For if we truly accept it, life is no longer as difficult. Nonetheless, Habermas offers the best advice I have read to Christians who experience pain, based on Christian assumptions. First off, he admits that for all of the Christian responses to divine hiddenness arguments, which I'll address in chapter 15, Christians are still quite bothered by God's silence. Habermas even knows of the Christian responses to these arguments, and yet he has still struggled with the pain of losing his wife. He says, probably the most common issue I hear today has to do broadly with believers who are bothered by the subject of God's silence. Sounds about right to me. If God cares for people, then at the very least he could tell us why we suffer as much as we do. If he had done so, it would help alleviate the pain somewhat. Habermas argues correctly, in my opinion, that the primary cause of our emotional suffering is internal, emanating from our own false beliefs, whereas rational, true, or good beliefs about reality promote positive results, irrational or bad beliefs often have painful consequences. Okay, so far. But which beliefs serve as corrective to help Christians in their pain and suffering? The first one is that suffering is at the heart of the gospel. God never promised a life without suffering, he notes. In fact, Jesus suffered as did the early disciples, so believers should actually expect to suffer as well. He says Scripture does not teach what believers will be exempted from suffering, even from the worst sorts. Neither do the lives of the saints bear this out. And he argues that somehow we need to drive home these points, and forcefully so. A second belief, only briefly mentioned, is that God knows why Christians are suffering and is by their side. The third belief is that Christians should focus on their heavenly rewards, saying, this is a truth that we should always concentrate on, for it both changes our perspective on this life as well as providing motivation in the present. What can we say in response? First, his advice almost completely ignores God's many promises. Let's look at them. God will provide for our daily needs. Do not be worried about your life as to what you will eat or what you will drink, not for your body as to what you will put on. Is not your life more than food and the body more than clothing? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. Matthew 6:25-32. God answers prayer. This is the confidence which we have before him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us, and if we know that, he hears us in whatever we ask. We know that we have the requests which we have asked from him. 1 John 5:14-15. God gives us the desires of our heart. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Psalm 37:4. God heals our diseases. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget none of his benefits, who pardons all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases. Psalm 103:1-3. God promises long life. For through me your days will be many, and years will be added to your life. Proverbs 9:11. God promises protection. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. Psalm 121:7-8. God promises deliverance. For God will deliver the needy when he cries, the poor also, and him who has no helper. Psalm 72:12. There are lots of these kinds of promises in the Bible. Promises, promises. If God does fulfill his promises, even partially, then where is the evidence of this in the lives of so many Christian people? No wonder Christians struggle so much when they suffer. If Habermas is correct, then why did this God make these promises? That doesn't make any sense to me. Either Habermas is correct or God is, you see. It seems clear to me that Habermas is either haphazardly exegeting the Bible based on the facts of experience, not properly exegeting it. He needs to have an emotional answer so badly that he denies the Bible, even though he is a card-carrying inerrantist. Typical Christian. Do or say anything that can't be said in order to save one's faith. The problem is that the faith he saves is not the faith handed down to him, for now he doesn't have any real hope in God's promises. What Habermas says is probably the best pastoral answer I've read, but it falls on deaf ears. I dare say it will fall on his own deaf ears should some other painful experience come his way, something I do not wish upon him. As I have said before, it's better over here. Only people with a certain disposition, people who can handle the truth, people who can be brutally honest with the evidence wherever it leads, people who are not afraid of letting go of that crutch to see whether they can walk without it, will ever find this out. Chapter 13. Honestly admit there are no solutions. There have been several historical attempts to fully justify a perfectly good, omnipotent, omniscient God in light of the suffering we experience in this world. There have been three major solutions offered, also known as theodicies. None of them work, so would-be apologists should just honestly admit there are no solutions. The solution of Augustine. The traditional answer usually associated with Augustine in the 4th century CE is that natural and morally caused suffering entered the world as the result of an angelic and then a human fall into sin. All suffering is either due to our sin or the consequences of our sin, explaining why there is both natural and moral suffering in our world. God allows us to reap the full individual, societal, and global consequences of our own sins, but God sent Christ to ransom us on the cross from Satan's power and thereby overcame that which brought evil into the world, sin. Sin that is justly punished in Christ is thereby canceled out and no longer mars the universe. God will eventually be victorious over evil in the end on Judgment Day. There's more to it, and R. Douglas Gevatt is a good guide who finds merit in Augustine's approach. Gevatt claims Augustine's deductive proof for God's existence plays a crucial role in his theodicy. Augustine reasoned like this in three steps. 1. God exists based on the need to ground eternal truth, a Platonic argument. 2. God is necessarily good, whereas all other things by virtue of being created are contingent goods. 3. Therefore, a necessarily good God couldn't create evil. By definition, God cannot be responsible for it. I'll confess this is a rather simple account for brevity's sake. As I indicated, this is a deductive argument, one based on definitions. If we define things in the way Augustine did, then we'll get the same results. That is, if it is in fact deductively true beyond doubt that God is necessarily good, then we couldn't create the massive amount of suffering in the world, i.e. evil. The question is how Augustine gets from A to Z. Gevatt says Augustine's argument to a necessarily good God is not just a deductive one, for Augustine offered inductive support for it as well in the feelings of guilt we have from time to time. However, I can conceive of no reasonable argument that would lead us to think God is necessarily good given the nature of the world we see around us, especially given other God hypotheses. Consider the world we see around us. There is no way we can conclude there is a perfectly good God if we inductively look at the world and try to determine whether such a God, if he exists, is necessarily good. At best, we could only inductively conclude God has a mixture of both good and evil in him, Paul Draper's hypothesis of indifference. Perhaps God is a glorified human being. After all, human beings contain a mixture of both good and bad, which is what we would inductively conclude about God from the world. So Augustine's so-called inductive support for his deductive argument to God's goodness is merely used in defense of something he already determined from his deductive argument, devoid of any inductive reasoning at all. Augustine is defining God as necessarily good without any non-controversial inductive support. The experience of guilt is no indication there is a perfectly good God given naturalistic explanations they locate it in the conscious region of our brains. With his definitions and the deductive nature of his argument, he doesn't need any inductive evidence at all. In fact, such evidence is irrelevant. Now consider other more probable God hypotheses. One such God hypothesis is that a trickster or deceiver God exists, rather than a good one. Based on this conception alone, the best any believer can claim is agnosticism, for any evidence suggesting God is good is placed there by a trickster God who seeks to deceive us. Another one is the God of process theology, whereby God is not omnipotent. God cannot intervene to help us. He only has the power to persuade moral agents like us to do good deeds. He cares, it's just that he cannot directly intervene because he cannot control his creatures. He can only influence them. With such a theodicy, God does not need to be justified for permitting evil, since it is not within his power to prevent it. Basically, process theology concedes the whole argument. Augustine also argued that evil is a privation, that it doesn't exist except as a privation of goodness. It is a corruption of the good. Plato's allegory of the cave is illustrative here, although Gevatt doesn't mention it. Augustine essentially borrowed some of Plato's insights with Christian deviations. In Plato, the real is the good, i.e. the highest of the forms to be found when prisoners escape the cave, while that which is unreal are the shadows or the cave wall that the prisoner saw. When we substitute the word God for Plato's good and substitute the word evil for Plato's shadows, we basically get Augustine. Evil is unreal like the shadows on the cave. It doesn't exist except as a parasite on the good. So evil has no actual substance or existence in and of itself. It's a privation of the good. Augustine argued that evil is a privation, but could he argue that suffering is a privation? Just substitute the word suffering in place of the word evil, as is my preference, and see what we get. You see, that's what we're talking about. Suffering, a massive amount of intense suffering that is caused naturally and morally. It exists. No Platonic deductive argument now has any alternative definition that can deny this fact. How does suffering not exist? Sentient creatures all experience it as real. To say evil is the absence of goodness puzzles me to no end, for all I can think of when reading this are the individual people who have suffered, especially children. What exactly does it mean to my children are born addicted to cocaine or with cystic fibrosis, Down syndrome, congenital heart disease, or leukemia? Do we really want to say they're experiencing the absence of goodness? Does this language make any sense at all? What we have here, ladies and gentlemen, is a language reversal game with the privation theory. For rather than the problem of evil, we have the problem of less good. Why didn't God create a world with more good in it? Andrea Weisberger explains less good simply functions as a euphemism for evil, and the problem reduces to a matter of semantics. No matter what we wish to call the particular phenomenon in question, the pain feels the same. Certainly the problem of evil disappears, it is true, but the problem of less good which takes its place is equally vexing. Weisberger continues in her book Suffering Belief, there is clearly a major problem with the privation theory. It does not seem to satisfactorily account for our experience of evil. She also argues the solution of Augustine and Aquinas is a concessionary one, for it concedes that the problem of evil as traditionally formulated is a sound argument. It just denies one of the premises, i.e. that evil exists. Givet admits that Augustine's view of evil as a privation is often met with incredulity or something worse. These are some of the reasons why. Givet ends his chapter with some lessons for today. Let me mention the first and the last sessions, the only ones worth a commitment. The first lesson is everyday worldview and philosophy of life must reckon with the reality of evil, including the evil of human and moral failure. Again, let's substitute the word suffering for the word evil, and this now reads, every worldview and philosophy of life must reckon with the reality of suffering, including the suffering of human moral failure. He opines that atheists cannot answer the problem, that we loathe to say what evil is. Really? I just did. It's called suffering. Meritless, blind, undeserved suffering. Surely a child who suffers and dies from leukemia doesn't merit it. And what accounts for such suffering? In a word, evolution. The fourth and final lesson is Christianity is attractive in part for its solution to both the existential and the intellectual problems of evil. My response, given all that I'm saying in this section, is that I do every time I get a physical at the doctor's office. Cough. Such a statement is little more than masturbatory madness. It's circle jerk time, folks. For people who want to believe, all it takes is a little patience and some ingenuity. To see this for what it is, look at Scientology's solution to the problem of evil. Look at Christian Scientist's solution. Look at the pantheist solution. Look at the Calvinist solution. They all claim to have the best solution, so take your pick. Just try to argue them out of their solution, you will see the same resistance coming from evangelicals. Hint, they will disagree. That's why faith needs no evidence. That's the nature of faith. Objective evidence doesn't count, and when it does, it's forced into the service of faith. The best of all possible world solutions of Leibniz. G.W. Leibniz, 1646-1716, coined the term theodicy and argued that this is the best of all possible worlds. His reasoning went like this. A perfect God has the power to create any possible world. Being perfect, God could create the best possible world. No creaturely reality can be totally perfect but must contain some evil. So God created a world possessing the optimum balance of good and evil. This is the best of all possible worlds. In Jill Graper Hernandez's chapter on Leibniz for the book God and Evil, she tells us his theodicy. Our actual world is a result of the convergence of God's perfection and freedom. Even though the actual world contains imperfections that arise out of metaphysical limits, like my imperfect rationality, or out of choice, like my propensity to sin, but even though this created world is not perfect, it is the best possible, and so it would be impossible for God to create a better world or to intervene in the world to prevent or limit suffering within the created order. A perfect God would create only the best out of any world that could be conceived. Since this is the world God created, this is the best of all worlds that could be conceived, the best of all possible worlds. Leibniz's views was ridiculed by Voltaire in his satirical novel Candide, French for Optimism, published in 1759, a satire that Hernandez fails to mention. In the novel, we watch Candide's slow and painful disillusionment with Leibniz's theodicy as he witnesses and experiences great hardships in the world. Since Voltaire's day, Christian philosophers tried to escape these criticisms by arguing God does not need to create the best of all possible worlds. Most philosophers think the notion of a best possible world is incoherent, including Robert Adams, Alvin Plantinga, and Robert Swinburne. But as atheist philosopher William Rowe argued, there is a distinction to be made between a best world and a best possible world. So if there is a best world, not a best possible world, God would have no other choice than to create it. For, as he tells us, to do less good than one could is to be lacking in wisdom or in goodness. So even if this present world is not the best possible world, it should still be a best world. In fact, if a perfect God created a world, it would have to be a perfect one, otherwise God created imperfection into existence. In partial defense of Leibniz and recognizing his theodicy has a lot to answer for, Norman Geisler claimed this present world is the best possible way to get to the best possible world, in heaven. But this is clearly not the best possible way to get to the best possible world. For with just one fewer murder or drought or rape, this would be a better world leading up to the best possible world. Hernandez tells us the Leibnizian theodicy is based on the fact that God acts for good reasons and is consistent with Leibniz's principle of pre-established harmony, which is laughed at by almost everyone who studies the brain-mind problem, and human free will, which is a crucial requirement. Hernandez tells us God sees the entire sequence of events in the world as a whole, and when he chooses the entire series, which is the best. Since God is perfect, he will always be obligated to limit the amount of evil in the world unless his intervention would result in more, or qualitatively worse, evil obtaining. Hernandez says Leibniz's solution has remained philosophically compelling for many reasons, yet mentions a telling criticism that is divorced from the lived suffering of people. She admits it might be too abstract since Leibniz doesn't engage in significant discourse over pernicious harms. On both accounts and for many reasons, she's right about these two criticisms. That's because Leibniz's theodicy is pure philosophical speculation based on a good God. Granted that this has to be the best possible world for such a being to create, or at least a perfect world among other perfect worlds as he would have created. However, no matter what world we could have experienced, no matter what world God could have created, apologists in those other worlds could still say the same thing as Leibniz did. The world would be much, much worse, and apologists could still deduce from the undemonstrable first principle of their philosophy that such a world would be a perfectly good one based on the idea of a perfectly good God. That's why pure deduction as a theodicy does not work. We must begin by looking at the world we experience and inductively conclude from it what kind of God must exist if one does. Otherwise, what apologists are doing is nothing less than special pleading. A solution to the problem of suffering based in Leibniz's deductive form of special pleading is no solution at all. Potential apologists should take note. The soul-making solution of John Hick. John Hick has argued for a soul-making theodicy, something far removed from traditional Christianity. For him, two stages of creation are involved. In the first place, humans were brought into existence as intelligent animals, and then secondly, through their own free choices, human beings are gradually being transformed into God's children. Perfection lies in the future of our existence through successive reincarnations, or more properly, the successive creation of exact replicas of us. This theodicy requires an epistemic distance from God where the world was created so it appears as if he doesn't exist at all. This makes it possible for us to freely accept God's gracious invitation and to come to him as uncompelled faith and love. This theodicy also requires that we reject a historical fall from innocence and accept a universal salvation of all people. In Hick's world, the suffering we experience and overcome are necessary for our character building. I find it very interesting, of course, to see liberal Christians like Hick trying to remodel their faith in light of the advancement of the sciences. He accepts the science has seriously damaged the house of Christianity, yet he tries to rebuild the Christian faith out of the discarded timber using other religious beliefs like reincarnation. As an evangelical, James Spiegel is not defending this soul-making solution on theodicy in his chapter on God and Evil on the subject. He doesn't even mention Hick's two stages of creation, Adam and Eve's fall into sin, epistemic distance, or reincarnation. In this chapter, Spiegel is arguing that some suffering is necessary for our character building. That's his thesis. It only has a tangential relationship to the soul-making theodicy that receives its most excessive treatment by John Hick. But if this is his thesis, and if some suffering is necessary, then he should comment on just how much suffering is necessary. He needed to defend more than just some suffering is necessary, and tell us just how much suffering is represented by that little word, some. Sometimes people are absolutely devastated by their suffering to the point of suicide or debilitating depression. How does that create good moral character in them? Do these people suffer for the express utilitarian purpose of helping the rest of us learn moral traits when we help them? Does the amount of intense suffering in this world help us better than working with people on a project like building a house or being a member of a sports team that's sometimes a struggle, even a battle of egos? Does a mother not learn to love her children until they suffer and die from leukemia? How do suffering children teach a mother to love them more than if her children didn't suffer at all? Spiegel also needs to tell us what he thinks of the fall into sin by Adam and Eve. Was that necessary too? It has to be if he wants to defend his thesis. Otherwise, without any suffering, there would be no character building. Spiegel should also comment on how human beings can achieve enough character development through suffering on earth to be perfect when they reach heaven. If there is no suffering in heaven, then character developing stops upon entrance to it. If the saved have not been perfected by that time, then they will forever remain in the moral stage they were in when they died. That's why Hick also proposes successive reincarnation so that exact replicas of us could somehow attain perfection. Spiegel needs to tell us if his God instantaneously makes people perfect upon arrival in heaven. If so, wouldn't this abrogate their free will? And if God does this in heaven, then why couldn't he do so for people before reaching heaven? If God is prepared to violate free will in heaven, then why not on earth? Furthermore, Spiegel writes as if compassion, patience, and generosity are all important moral traits to learn from suffering, but he never answers the question as to why we should need these traits in heaven if there is no suffering. Without suffering in heaven, there is no need for those moral traits at all. That would be no reason for compassion since no one suffers, nor patience since there is nothing to be impatient about, and no need for generosity when there is no want. Lacking an answer to these types of questions, Spiegel isn't defending a theodicy at all. At best, he's offering a partial solution, something he admits. He asserts the other part of his solution is the free will theodicy of Augustine. When the soul-making theodicy is taken together with Augustine's theodicy, Spiegel thinks they provide a powerful response to the problem. But until he answers the type of question I have asked, we don't know if these two theodicies are complementary at all. Are they? He cannot just assert that they are complementary. Hick's theodicy stands opposed to the theodicy of Augustine. If Spiegel wants to pick and choose between them, he needs to compare and contrast them. He did not do that. Until he does, it's hard to know how to criticize arguments that are left unstated. Spiegel's thesis is a very small one, almost irrelevant to the real issue. It gets him nowhere toward the larger issue of his immense and ubiquitous amount of intensive suffering in this present world. He doesn't come close to defending the thesis that most suffering is necessary at all. And for him to defend a real theodicy, he needs to argue that all suffering is probably necessary. Process theologian David R. Griffin criticized Hick in these words. Hick provides no reason why God should have wasted over 4 billion years setting the stage for the only thing thought to be intrinsically valuable, the moral and spiritual development of human beings, and the high probability that hundreds of millions of years of that preparation involved unnecessary and unuseful pain counts against Hick's defense of the omnipotent God total goodness. Surely an all-wise omnipotent being could have found some happier middle ground between our present, all-too-destructive world and the hedonistic paradise. Hick fears would make us morally and spiritually flabby. Is a creator who has the power to create a completely different type of world and yet who deliberately builds earthquakes, tornadoes, and cancer into the structure of the world, who creates us so that moral evil is necessary, moral evil that can produce Hiroshimas and Auschwitzes? Is a deity who would do all this solely for the sake of knowing that some of its creatures came to love their creator freely, limitlessly good? So not only does Hick's God not care for animals, which is an argument I've made before, it seems like a complete waste of successive human lives along with our suffering to perfect our souls like this, when other means to the same end could work just as effectively. David Hume argued that it's quite possible we could be motivated by pleasure alone rather than pain. Hume argues, pleasure alone in its various degrees seemed to humans understanding sufficient for this purpose. All animals might be constantly in a state of enjoyment, but when urged by any of the necessities of nature, such as thirst, hunger, weariness, instead of pain, they might feel a diminution of pleasure, by which they might be prompted to seek that object which is necessary to their subsistence. Men pursue pleasure as eagerly as they avoid pain, at least they might have been so constituted. It seems, therefore, plainly possible to carry on the business of life without any pain. Why, then, is any animal ever rendered susceptible of such a sensation? If animals can be free from it in an hour, they might enjoy a perpetual exemption from it, and it required a contrivance of their organs to produce that feeling, as to endow them with sight, hearing, and any of the senses. Shall we conjecture that such a contrivance was necessary, without any appearance of reason? And shall we build on that conjecture as on the most certain truth? As illustrations of Hume's pleasure principle in action, neither children nor pets need to be hit, spanked, or beat in order for them to learn how to behave well. Rewards and praises can do this very effectively. If they misbehave, then a stern look of displeasure or a time out in the corner can be effective. We can ground our children or cage our pets. These kind of things do the training trick quite nicely and humanely. And even if we think some kind of pain is necessary for embodied people to have, like hunger pains that can motivate us to work for a living or to help us avoid touching a hot plate, the pain we experience does not need to be as intense as it presently is. God could give us a greater pain threshold, or he could deaden our senses by degrees. Special pleading God's attributes. Before ending this chapter, I want to briefly indicate how special pleading is used as a substitute for apologetics when it comes to the problem of suffering and an omni-God. If you want to be a Christian apologist, then you must master this art. If you want to be a good Christian apologist, you must avoid doing this entirely. Although, if you avoided doing so, you wouldn't be an apologist at all. I have found Christian apologists to be experts at picking and choosing between God's attributes of omnipotence, omniscience, and omnibenevolence, or perfect goodness, depending on the problem to be solved. When it comes to God's omnipotence in the face of so much intense suffering, apologists conveniently negate it by focusing instead on God's omniscience, saying we cannot understand his ways. God, like a father, knows best. They'll say when it comes to explaining why an omnipotent God allows so much suffering. So in order to save their faith from refutation, they must allow God's omnipotence to go only so far, and no farther. This is where his power arbitrarily ends, where the apologist needs it to end to solve a problem for faith. Process theologians like John B. Cobb Jr. and David Ray Griffin have even been forced to deny God's omnipotence in order to solve the problem of suffering. According to them, God merely has the power to persuade. He doesn't have coercive power. When it comes to God's omniscience in the face of so much intense suffering, apologists conveniently negate it by focusing instead on God's omnibenevolence, that God created a perfectly good world despite the fact that doing so meant there was the probability, or real possibility, free creatures would disobey. They will claim God didn't know how to create free-willed creatures who never disobey, or at the minimum don't disobey very often, or in such inhumane ways. So in order to save their faith from refutation, they must allow God's omniscience to go only so far and no farther. This is where his knowledge arbitrarily ends, where the apologist needs it to end to solve a problem for faith. Evangelicals such as the late Clark Pinnock, along with John E. Sanders, Richard Rice, and Gregory Boyd, are even embracing open theism, which denies God can foreknow future free-willed human actions. Christian apologists will even negate God's omnibenevolence if that is what's required to believe, since there is clear evidence for a great amount of gratuitous suffering in the lives of so many people, suffering that has no ultimate explanation for the individuals who are suffering. Evangelicals such as Michael Peterson, the late William Hasker, and Bruce Little deny that it's called meticulous providence. In their view, some of our suffering is because God is not directly involved in our daily lives. According to them, God does not care to be involved in our daily lives, so we suffer as a result. If this isn't their point, then what is? Certainly an omniscient God knows how to intervene. Certainly an omnipotent God has the ability to do so. Shouldn't an omnibenevolent God have the motivation to do so? It should be easy for God to eliminate the horrendous suffering in our lives. That's not too much to ask of a truly omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent deity, is it? If you name any specific example of horrendous suffering in the world, I can easily show how such a God could have eliminated it without adversely affecting anything else, since such a deity would be able to perform what I have previously called perpetual miracles. If we accept that God is omnipotent, for instance, and that he created the universe from nothing, then he should be able to perform perpetual miracles. So God could miraculously intervene without us ever knowing that he had done so. As I've said, he could have stopped the underwater earthquake that caused the Indonesian tsunami of 2004 with a snap of his omnipotence. omnipotent fingers, and 250,000 people would not have died. Then, with a perpetual miracle, he could have prevented it from ever occurring in the future. He would never be the wiser if we wanted to remain hidden from some unknown reason, for, from our perspective, it would never have taken place. The fact is that more knowledgeable and powerful a person is, the greater that person's moral responsibility to help others who are experiencing horrendous suffering. Just think of a helpless slave girl who was being whipped by a southern plantation owner. A person who didn't know what was taking place could not have been held morally responsible for not doing anything to stop it. A person who knew it was taking place but had no power to stop it could not have been held morally responsible for not doing anything to stop it. Since God is believed to be both omniscient and omnipotent, he bears the highest possible degree of responsibility to stop it. The best explanation for God not helping that girl, or any of us who intensely suffer, is that God isn't omnibenevolent. So in order to save their faith from refutation, Christian apologists must allow God's omnibenevolence to go only so far, and no farther. This is where his perfection loved ends, where the apologist needs it to end to solve a problem of faith. Apologists look at the world and force their conceptions of God to fit what they see. It is emphatically not the case that they first define their God based on the perfect being theology derived from Anselm's ontological argument to God's existence. The greatest conceivable being, that which no greater being can be conceived, ends up being the same one that best suits their needs for faith. For when it comes to their conceptions of God, they conclude he didn't have the power to create a world without naturally caused suffering, that he didn't know how to create a world where they are free creatures who never disobey, and that he doesn't care enough to intervene in our lives on a daily basis. Either their ontological conceptions of the perfect being really mean something, or they don't. Christian apologists cannot arbitrarily negate them when it suits their faith. What they should do instead is take their ontological conceptions of God and ask what kind of world should exist if such a God created it, rather than look at the world that presently exists and force their conceptions of God to fit it. Doing what they do is little more than special pleading. They cannot continue this type of intellectual gerrymandering if they want to be taken seriously. To paraphrase John F. Kennedy, ask not what kind of God should exist given this present world, ask what kind of world should exist if God exists. But then, if you do this, you wouldn't be an apologist at all. Seriously. Conclusion. If Christian theists want to produce a theodicy, they need to do at least five things. First, they must produce a coherent notion of what they are talking about. What does it mean when they use the word God, good, perfect, or best possible world, free will, and so on? What does it mean to have omnipotence, omniscience, or omnibenevolence? On these types of questions, I have found chapter 4 of James Lindsay's book, God Doesn't, We Do, Only Humans Can Solve Human Challenges, to be excellent. Especially damning on these concepts are parts 4 and 5 of Michael Martin and Ricky Monier's anthology, The Impossibility of God. Take, for instance, the word good. If God is not good in the same sense we think of the word good, and if he is not held to the same moral standards we hold others to whom we call good, then God cannot be an object of worship or be viewed as morally good. For him to be worthy of worship and morally good, his behavior has to be in accord with our notions of what we would consider to be worship-worthy and good. Second, they must argue to the existence of the God of their specific definitions, as opposed to other notions of God. A lot of ink is wasted between them on just how to properly conceive of the God within the Christian tradition, much less of the many other God concepts people believe in. Third, they must consistently apply these notions. I have argued previously that they will pick and choose between God's omniscience, omnibenevolence, and omnipotence whenever it suits them, depending on the issue to be solved. When pressed against a wall, they will say anything to get out of the problem that calls into question their faith. Let's recall again Stephen Law's insightful observation. Anything based on faith, no matter how ludicrous, can be made to be consistent with the available evidence, given a little patience and ingenuity. Fourth, they must show that the God they are defending is biblically based. We do not find such a God as they are defending in the Bible. All they would have to do is read Jack O'Grady's chapter, Can God Exist If Yahweh Doesn't?, in The End of Christianity. Fifth, they must honestly deal with the empirical evidence we see around us. I consider the empirical evidence to be as close to a refutation of their God as we find, as I'll argue in the last chapter of this book. What should we conclude? Michael Martin writes about a hypothetical guy named Jones who is dead, and some of his friends suspecting a cover-up by the police. It's possible there is a police cover-up of the evidence, of course, but they can produce no evidence this is the case. In the context of religion, he writes, the idea that God's reason for evil are comprehensible has been widely accepted by theologians from St. Augustine to Hick, who have attempted to specify what those reasons are. Every attempt to formulate a systematic theodicy confirms the view that is commonly accepted that it is possible to understand why, if God exists, there is evil. Naturally, a failure of all such attempts might have driven theists to claim that the reasons are beyond comprehension. But without independent support, such a claim rings hollow. For example, Jones' friend could claim that despite their repeated failures to expose a police cover-up, there is one nonetheless. They could say the police are so clever and cunning that exposing such a cover-up is all but impossible. But without independent evidence, this charge is ad hoc and arbitrary. The same is true in the context of the problem of evil. Chapter 14. Blame Anything But the Creator God. The problem I wish to examine here is how sin and suffering originated and the final consequences for it all. In a chapter for the book God and Evil, Paul Copen, the president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, addressed how sin and suffering originated. The possible suspects are Adam, Eve, Satan, the environment, or God himself. Copen argues that he has the answer. Adam and Eve done it. He says this evening through Adam and Eve are two separate potential sources for the origination of sin and suffering. Many sexist and misogynistic theologians have simply blamed Eve. Others who blame only Adam deny that Eve could actually make such a choice on her own since she didn't have the authority to do so. If Adam had not made the same choice as Eve, there wouldn't have been a fall into sin, they'll say. This is a male religion, plain and simple, folks. Why any woman would embrace the religion of their oppressors baffles me. Copen ignores this problem, saying instead they are both to blame. Okay? Who done it? Those of us who don't have a problem with the origination of suffering or evil are reasonable people who accept the fact of evolution. Suffering is part of the process whereby lives evolve. The tales of an Adam and Eve are pure myth and science backs this up, as I've said, but it's a problem for believers given their belief in a good, omnipotent, omniscient God who created the world. Copen first takes aim against R.C. Sproul Jr., yes, the senior's son, whom Copen describes as a hyper-Calvinist. Sproul argues that God himself introduced evil into the world. Now get this, Sproul argues the reason God wanted Adam and Eve to sin is because of God's eternal attribute of wrath. God is as delighted with his wrath as he is with all of his attributes. So with this attribute, God must create objects of wrath, or as God would say, something on which I can exhibit the glory of my wrath. Without these objections of wrath, God would not be able to display his glory in the fullest way. Sproul says it was God's desire to make his wrath known. He needed, then, something on which to be wrathful. He needed to have sinful creatures. Sproul's case can be found in several biblical passages, like Isaiah 45:7. I form the light and create darkness. I bring prosperity and create disaster. I, the Lord, do all these things. Lamentations 3:37-38. Who can speak and have it happen, if the Lord has not decreed it? It is not from the mouth of the Most High that both disasters and good things come. Amos 3:6. When a trumpet sounds in a city, do not the people tremble. When disaster comes to a city, has not the Lord caused it? Proverbs 16:4. The Lord works out everything to its proper end, even the wicked for a day of disaster. The Hebrew word for disaster as translated in these texts indicates war, famine, drought, floods, and so on. Copen argues that these passages don't describe God doing evil, presumably because God works all evil out for the good, Genesis 15:20, Acts 2:22-14, and Romans 8:28, or he's punishing people for their sins. So is God causing suffering here or not? That is what we're talking about, right? And don't children who suffer when God strikes a city with a disaster? Shouldn't they also suffer along with the adults who sinned? And what about any adults who don't sin? Were they whisked away from the trouble like Lot and his family supposedly were in his day? Or were the innocents to suffer too? Would-be apologists should study what Copen says so they know how to do apologetics correctly. Maybe Copen and Sproul should both just listen in biblical theology professor Wilter Wink, who informs us about the God of the Old Testament in his book Unmasking the Powers. The original faith of Israel actually had no place for Satan. God alone was Lord, and thus whatever happened for good or ill was ascribed to God. I kill and I make alive, says the Lord. I wound and I heal. It was not inconsistent on the one hand to believe that God might call Moses to deliver Israel from Egypt, and on the other hand for God to want to murder him the other way. When Pharaoh resisted Moses, it was not ascribed to his free will, but to God's hardening of his heart. Likewise, it is God who sent an evil spirit on Saul, and it was God who sent a lying spirit to enter the mouths of the 400 prophets of Ahab. One possible translation of Yahweh, God's name, is He causes to happen what happens. If, then, God has caused everything that happens, God must also cause evil. But God was also the God of justice. So how could God be just and still be the one to cause evil? That was the terrible price Israel had been forced to pay for its belief that God was the primary cause of all that happens. Gradually, God became differentiated into a light and a dark side, both integral to the Godhead. The bright side came to be represented by the angels, the dark side by Satan and his demons. This process of differentiation took a long time to complete. I think both Sproul and Copan are right, and they both are wrong. They both fail to understand the evolutionary trajectory of the texts they're dealing with. Sproul is right when, given some earlier texts, God does cause disasters and suffering. He is wrong, however, not to see that such a view was eventually ascribed to Satan because in evil doing, God was thought to be irreconcilable with a loving, sovereign God. Given the destruction put upon the Jews by Antiochus Epiphanes in the 2nd century BC, Jews just couldn't understand why a good sovereign God would do this to them. So they concluded there must be another source for that evil, and Satan was born. So if later biblical writers had to create or adopt Satan because of the problem of suffering, then Sproul is out of touch with their evolved moral intuitions, the ones I share without punting to a mythical creature like the devil. Sproul is out of touch with reality. Copan is right when he argues that Sproul's view denies God's goodness and espouses divine neediness and, I add, barbarism to the core. Copan is wrong, however, to argue that Adam and Eve are the culprits, singular, with their so-called free will choice in the garden to disobey God. Almost unbelievably, all Copan can do is quote from creeds, Augustine, and other biblical passages. It's quite obvious that what he's doing, at least to me. Grant Copan the creeds in the Bible, then Adam and Eve's sin was culpable, avoidable, involuntary. He's quoting myths to explain how the primeval couple was led into sin. He totally avoids questions like why were they created as curious people in the first place? Why was the serpent allowed to tempt them, especially if God knew they would sin? Even if God didn't know the outcome with certainty, he surely knew the probabilities were very high. Why weren't they given enough evidence to take him at his word what eating the fruit would lead to serious consequences for all subsequent life on earth? And so on. So Copan, too, is out of touch with the reality, not unlike Sproul. What we have in this myth is nothing but etiology. These stories are told for the purpose of helping to explain why things are the way they are, not how things originated. How did we gain knowledge and wisdom? Why do men and women marry? Why do snakes crawl on the ground? Why do women fear snakes? Why do men rule over women? Why are women subservient to men? Why do women experience pain in childbirth? Why is it so very painfully hard to work the land? Why are there weeds? Why is there famine, disease, and death? Why do we clothe ourselves rather than run around naked? Why do we die? It's all here. Etiological stories used to explain why things are the way they are. Litter the ancient archives. There is no historical truth to such tales at all. If you really want to know what the Jews thought was the real fall into sin, it's told in Genesis 6, 1-4. It opens up with description of the evils that had finally taken place on earth. There was a new and horrible evil. The divine sons of God were having sex with the daughters of men and producing semi-divine offspring giants called Nephilim. This biblical text tells us that divine beings have genitalia and produced offspring. Yep, that's right, nothing but myth. This was viewed as a deliberate act of rebellion that Donald Gowan tells us was understood by early Jewish commenters to be more important than the story of the sin of Adam and Eve. For several authors, this was the true false story, the account of how evil came into the world by means of the descent of certain rebellious angels. The fact is that if the story of Adam and Eve in the garden was that big of a deal, there are plenty of places in the Old Testament where it could be used, specifically in Proverbs for instruction, and in Job when dealing with the problem of suffering, but it's not referred to in the whole Old Testament except in a nebulous, nondescript way in Ezekiel. The truth is that the origin of sin is never traced back to Adam and Eve in the Old Testament. The concept didn't emerge until the intertestamental period between the Old and New Testaments, especially in the apocryphal and the forged literature. In these texts, we first find that as the point of the story. We find such a viewpoint expressed in non-canonical writings like the Wisdom of Solomon, where we read, "For God created man for incorruption, and made him in the image of his own eternity, but through the devil's envy death entered the world, and those who belong to his party experience it." In 2 Ezra 7:1-18, we read, "O Adam, what have you done? Your sin was not only your own downfall, it was also the downfall of all of us who are your descendants." Old Testament scholar Klaus Westermann accurately tells us, "The teaching of the fall and of original sin rests on the late Jewish interpretations. It has no foundation at all in the Genesis narrative." Original sin? The doctrine of original sin is an in-house debate between Christians. There is a huge divide among evangelicals themselves over this whole issue. They don't agree with each other about the nature of original sin or the consequences of it. Paul Copan is an Arminian, which is a later improved development of Pelagianism, as are the rest of the contributors to the book God and Evil. No other Christians need apply. Perhaps, like me, they think Calvinism does not adequately solve the problem of evil, to say at least. I think that is a major agreement between us. If God is sovereign, as Calvinists claim, then he can do pretty much anything he wants to with a complete and total disregard for decency and morality. I charge this kind of God as showing partiality by revealing himself to some people, not to others, even though he forbids us to show partiality, James 2. I think this kind of God is barbaric, since he lies to us, telling us he wants us to do one thing but secretly causes us to do something else. He doesn't abide by his own ethical obligations laid out in the Bible, whereby he can virtually violate all 10 commandments and still demand worship as a holy God. And he condemns people to hell simply because it brings him more glory. If, however, he can control our free-willed choices, then why didn't he make us all obey in the first place? Suffice it to say that if Calvinism is true, then God cannot be a good God because he decrees all the evil we experience in human history. All of it. No belief in God's inscrutable ways can absolve God of his guilt, and no alternative definition of human freedom can absolve God of his guilt either. Clark Pinnock, an evangelical and an open theist, responded to such a theology in these words. One need not wonder why people become atheists when faced with such a theology. A God like that has a great deal for which to answer. Paul Copan argues for several things in his chapter on the subject of original sin. 1. Original sin is contingent, not inevitable or necessary, saying, humans are not intrinsically essential or fundamentally evil. 2. Original sin is universal, saying humans are not divided into two camps, the good on one side and evil on the other. Sin pervades every heart. 3. Original sin is radical, saying sin is persuasive and affecting us deeply. 4. Original sin is communicable, saying our sinful condition has been passed from one generation to the next, extending back to Adam. He claims humans are not guilty for Adam's sin, but we are damaged or corrupted by it. We have an original corruption, a self-centered orientation that permeates all we do. He says for which we cannot be blamed. However, we are morally blameworthy when we personally choose to sin. Isn't our sin therefore inevitable? He asks. No, for although we will eventually sin, we don't sin necessarily. Eventually we will all sin, he says, but it isn't inevitable or logically necessary to say that we all sin. What can this distinction mean when it comes to human actions? I do not have the faintest clue. If we all sin, then it is inevitable that we all will sin. What else can the word inevitable mean? It does not help his case to deny that we sin out of any logical necessity, but for Copan this settles it. Is this language game of his supposed to solve the problem of a good God and human suffering? Since we don't sin out of a logical necessity, God is not to be blamed when we sin, even though we will all inevitably sin? Well then, may God be praised for this tiny itty-bitty escape from his own responsibility. Did he create us or not? If so, couldn't he have done better than this? Or is God incompetent, or worse, does he not exist in the first place? Again, would-be apologists should take note on how to do apologetics correctly. But what about Adam in the garden? What if we were given the same test under the same initial conditions? Then what? Copan believes God has middle knowledge such that he knows all counterfactual of each free decision that any of us would have made, which is to say God even knows the future of any world had made choices different from the ones we did. Therefore God would not know which human beings would have also sinned in the garden and created us into this present fallen world. If we exist on earth, that means we would have sinned in the garden. You see, even if we weren't in the Garden of Eden. Knowing this, God allows us all to begin exactly where each of us would have ended up anyway, namely in a fallen condition. Well, well, well. If God has that kind of foreknowledge, then he could just skip the trials of earth and merely create the people who would not have sinned in the garden directly into heaven itself. He wouldn't need to create the world for people who have disobeyed either, saving them from going to hell. Furthermore, Copan's God would have also foreknowledge who would accept Jesus for salvation and then simply create them in heaven too. Everyone who has ever created would end up in heaven. Glory be to God. But no. Even though God has this kind of foreknowledge and could alleviate so much suffering by utilizing it, he chose not to do so. So, we are back to where we started. When so much suffering? Neither Calvinism nor Copan's Arminianism offers us a clue. We are back to square one. The puzzling thing to me, the real puzzling thing, is why any reasonable person would accept Copan's answer. It just does not make any sense at all, not a bit. Typical apologetics. Budding apologists should once again take note. There are plenty of other things wrong with his assumptions. I can only deal with so much at a time. Dembski's solution. The focus of William Dembski's chapter for the book God and Evil is on theistic evolution. His charge is that theistic evolution renders the problem of evil insoluble. I agree, when theists legitimately criticize each other, I think they are all correct. The money quote on this comes from Clive Harden, who is a contributing writer on Dembski's blog, in response to theistic evolutionist Carl Giberson. Why would God be off the hook for creating a mechanism, evolution, that kills and destroys the way it does? For in Giberson's Theodicy, not only did God make the process of evolution, he set it in place and started it. This would be like me setting a bunch of mice, some infected with a plague, loose into a town. The mice have their own freedom to do whatever they want and go wherever they want and do it all without a moral dimension. This is nothing to get me off the hook for whoever as a result dies. Agreed. Yes. What's interesting to me is that the editors of the book God and Evil didn't include the main theses of Dembski's book, which seeks to offer a theodicy in the face of so much natural suffering. I've already written about it in my book Why I Became an Atheist, where I discuss several failed attempts to reconcile the Genesis creation accounts within the age of the universe. Dembski's attempt makes the list, so let me reproduce what I wrote about it below. Dembski argues in favor of the double creation theory of J.J. Dana, that chapter 1 of Genesis describes God's initial conceptual creation, which was good, as the good book says. But because God could anticipate the sin of Adam and Eve in the garden, Dembski says he retroactively made a second creation described in the story found in Genesis 2-3. Genesis 1 describes the first creation God had planned for the world, which is a real one, for it describes the natural divisions of his creative handiwork. But in Genesis 2-3, we find the second creation, which starts off great, but quickly ends in ruin. Thus, once humanity falls into sin in Genesis 3, God must act to undo the damage, and he says God could make the fall evident in creation to that these effects, though attributable to the fall, come temporarily prior to it. In other words, the effects of the fall can be retroactive. Thus, God responds to the fall by acting not simply after it, as held by young earth creationism, but also by acting before it. Genesis 1 is therefore not to be interpreted as ordinarily chronological time, but rather as time from the vantage point of God's purposes. Genesis 1 summarizes the order of creation by describing God's original plan for creation, but given that God responded to human sin across time both retroactively and proactively, there never was a chronological moment when the world we inhabit was without natural evil. Dembski claims God retroactively created the universe based on the fall into sin with natural evils built into it, like the bubonic plague, bacterium, the rabies virus, and the toothpick fish of the Amazon, which can swim up a penis and cannot be dislodged short of a surgery or castration, to name a few. So God initially created a perfect world, but then recreated it with natural evils from the beginning because of the later sin of humans in the Garden of Eden. There is absolutely no textual support for this conjecture of his at all. It's just speculation in order to come to grips with what science has shown us about the age of the universe. That there are two creation stories in Genesis 1 through 2 is evident. That other creation stories, especially the ones in Job 38:38-41, 39:26-30, and 104:20-22, describe predation in the other natural world is also evident. It's just that it makes much more sense to interpret them according to the times they were written in, an ancient pre-scientific age. That's doing exegesis. What Dembski is doing is eisegesis, or reading into the text his own biases. What Dembski is doing with this argument is puzzle solving. He's not interested in searching for the truth. How do we know this? Because no biblical scholar embraces such a bizarre solution. Dembski isn't one, and J.J. Dana was a geologist. Furthermore, the solution doesn't solve the problem of animal pain and suffering, something I've written extensively about. Even if Dembski is correct, what did animals do to deserve their sufferings? Nothing. So whence then do they suffer? William A. Dembski isn't the only one who thinks God can answer prayers retroactively. So did C.S. Lewis and recently Kevin Timp. Since Dembski believes in a God who can retroactively change the past, his proposal prevents a difficult, concerning prayer. If his God can change the past, then why doesn't he do so in response to prayer? If God answers prayer retroactively, believers could pray for the past to be changed just as they do in praying for present and future hopes to be realized. Can these apologists really have it both ways, saying God can answer these prayers but also denying that the past can be changed? So let me suggest a scientific test if God can answer these kinds of prayers. Pick an event in the past and pray that God changes it. The event could be as simple as praying that some kids who were in a car accident and died the night before did not die because there was no accident. My prediction is that the past will never be changed, and that every prayer to change the past will be remembered by the one who prayed it precisely because nothing will ever change, ever. What's your prediction? A free process defense? In a chapter for God and Evil, Gary Deweese aims to deploy the empirical phenomenon of chaos theories to help us understand why the world is such that natural evils occur. Basically arguing for John Polkinghorne's free process defense, Deweese claims such a line of reasoning is quite plausible with considerable empirical support. He argues God might well have good reason to create such a world, even with the possibility of natural evil. That is, chaos systems in our world make natural evil possible, and even perhaps inevitable. So even God cannot make such a world where natural evil never occurs. Deweese ends his chapter arguing that at least some natural evil is actually moral evil due to both demonic and human activity. When it comes to chaos theory, also known as the butterfly effect, Deweese claims that such a dynamic world order contrasted by a static one is beneficial to life, produces novel outcomes, and allows for human creativity. Fair enough. Of course it does. That's why we are here in the first place. Without such a dynamic world, we wouldn't exist. So what Deweese is doing is as follows. The world operates according to X. Therefore, God had to create a world that operates according to X. Here, God's omnipotence ends where the apologist needs it to end to solve a problem for faith. Why couldn't an omnipotent creator who creates ex nihilo out of nothing just create a different world? Go figure. Typically Christian. Same thing goes for God's omniscience. Aren't his ways supposed to be infinitely beyond our understanding? That's what we hear so many times, it's nauseating. But when it comes to solving the problem of massive, ubiquitous, naturally caused suffering in our world, the apologist argues God didn't have the omniscience necessary to create a different world than the one that presently exists. There is such a lack of imagination and ignorance here, it is stunning to me. I think faith stunts one's imagination and inspires ignorance. Look, either omnipotence means something or it does not. Either omniscience means something or it does not. No, not even a deity can do the logically impossible, nor can he know what is logically impossible to know. But limiting God's power and omniscience arbitrarily as apologists do so often is proof that faith is irrational. I'm looking at this world and asking whether or not God exists, while the apologist already believes God exists and is trying to explain why there is intense suffering in this world given that prior belief. The fact is that this world is not the one we would expect to find if there were a good God, and these two different perspectives make all the difference in the world. David Hume first made this distinction in these words. What if I show you a house or palace where there was not one apartment convenient or agreeable, where the windows, doors, fires, passages, stairs, and the whole economy of the building were the source of noise, confusion, fatigue, darkness, and the extremes of heat and cold? The architect would in vain attempt his subtlety and prove to you that if this door on the window were altered, greater ills would ensue. What he says may be strictly true, but you would assert in general that if the architect had skill and good intentions, it might have forced such a plan of the whole, and might have adjusted the parts in such a manner as would have resembled all the most of these inconveniences. His ignorance, or even your own ignorance of such a plan, will never convince you of the impossibility of it. If you find any inconveniences and deformities in the building, you will always, without entering into detail, condemn the architect. That being said, even a child could imagine a better natural world than this one. Here, I'll quote a selection from my book, Why I Became an Atheist. God should not have created predation in the natural world. The amount of creaturely suffering here is atrocious, as creatures prey on one another to feed themselves. All creatures should be vegetarian and or vegans, and in order to be sure there is enough vegetation for us all, God could have reduced our mating cycle and or male edible vegetation like apple trees, corn stalks, blueberry bushes, wheat, and tomato plants to grow as plenteous as wild weeds do today. God didn't even have to create us such that we needed to eat anything at all. If God created the laws of nature, then what's the problem? The process of photosynthesis could have fed us, something we find in the natural world. God could have created all human beings with one color of skin. There has been too many killings and slavery, and there have been too many wars, mostly because we do not all share the same racial background and language. God could have made all creatures sexually self-reproducing. Asexual reproduction could eliminate gender harassment and discrimination, since there wouldn't be any gender differences between us. Even if there are social benefits that result from two-parent sexual reproduction, societal ties could still be instilled within us by God. God could have created us with much stronger immune systems such that there would be no pandemics that decimate whole populations. God could have created us with self-generating bodies. When we receive a cut, it heals itself over time, as does a sprained ankle or even a broken bone. But why can't an injured spinal cord be made to heal itself? Why can't an amputated leg grow back in a few weeks? If that were all experienced in this world, we wouldn't know any different. We find a lot of these things in nature that God could have done for us. God could have created us with a much higher threshold of pain. He could have given us wings on our back so we could fly to safety if we were to fall off a cliff. He could have given us gills to keep us from drowning. Only if the theist expects very little from such a thing can he defend what God has done. Either God isn't smart enough to figure out how to create a good world, or he doesn't have the power to do it, or he just doesn't care. You pick. These are the logical options given this world. Let me comment briefly on Deweese's claim that at least some naturally caused suffering is morally evil due to both demonic and human activity. For this argument to work, there has to be evidence that Satan and his demons exist, as well as evidence that there was a fall into sin by Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Yes, there really are pseudo-intellectuals who believe this crap. I'll merely respond with two dilemmas. Dilemma regarding Adam and Eve. It's believed that there was a first human pair, Adam and Eve, who has grievously sinned against God. When tested, all that the rest of us are being punished for it, including animals, even though no one was but the first human pair deserved to be punished. If it's argued that all of us deserve to be punished because we all would have sinned, then the test was a sham, for only if some of us would have sinned can the test be considered a fair one. But if some of us would not have sinned under the same initial test conditions, then there are people who are being punished for something they never would have done. Dilemma regarding Satan. If Satan was the brightest creature in all of creation and he knew of God's immediate presence, absolute goodness, and omnipotent power like no one else, then to rebel against God makes him pure evil, suicidal, and dumber than a box of rocks. How is it really possible that any creature in the direct, unmeditated presence of God would want to rebel against the absolute goodness and love of an infinitely all-powerful being? Even if a creature wanted to rebel, he would know that such a rebellion would be absolutely futile. But since no rational being can be that evil or stupid, he doesn't exist at all. Furthermore, if such a God existed, he would never have allowed Satan to work his evil ways upon others unless they simply did not care.